Hello, one and all. My name is Marcus, and welcome to Player Advantage. This is episode 2, and it was supposed to be recorded on Sunday, the 26th. But then Kobe Bryant died, and suddenly I had to rethink the whole way I was going to do this episode and how things were going to work. The plan usually is to do, you know, what I've been watching, reading, playing, the media that I've been consuming up front, and then go into the news at the end. But this story is kind of too big to wait. It's too big to sit here and talk about Star Wars and Assassin's Creed and all these other things first, and then go back to. We're gonna talk about those things, but first, I think we have to talk about Kobe Bryant. Growing up in Southern California, Kobe was inescapable. He was the face of the most popular sports organization in the area I grew up in. I personally, not being a Laker fan, wasn't very big on him. I grew up a Bulls fan, still a Bulls fan, unfortunately. So I didn't have the same connection to him growing up that a lot of people do. It wasn't until I got older that I really started to develop that respect and admiration for him and his game, and how intense of a competitor he really was. You know, he's a guy who has very much inspired a lot of the guys around my age who are playing in the NBA. You know, guys like Devin Booker, Zach LaVine, Trae Young, Spencer Dinwiddie. Like, a lot of those guys who are in that early to mid-20s range, especially. Kobe is to them what Jordan was to Kobe. So, him being gone, it's kind of one of those things that's felt throughout the league, throughout sports, throughout pop culture as it exists. Kobe was Kobe, you know? Everyone knows him. Even people who don't know the first thing about basketball, people know the name Kobe Bryant. People know who that is. I don't think there's been a celebrity death as far-reaching and gigantic as this in a long time. I can't think of one. Maybe Michael Jackson? Prince, maybe? Because Muhammad Ali, you know, everyone knew that everyone knew who Ali was, and Ali was a lot older, where it was just like, you know, it's life. You get old, you die, you know? Kobe was only 41. He's younger than both my parents, who are young. You know, my dad is, see, I'm 25, so my dad's 46. My mom is 43. Still very young, comparatively, you know? And so Kobe, who's younger than both of them, to suddenly die in a helicopter crash alongside his 13-year-old daughter, it's so sudden and so bizarre. It's so hard to wrap your mind around, just as a concept. Like, the longer time goes on, the more myself and everyone will just have to get used to it. And everyone will adjust and life will go on. But this week, especially, every time I read the sentence, Kobe Bryant dead, or tribute to Kobe Bryant, or the late Kobe Bryant, it boggles the mind. Like, it's baffling, genuinely. It's so hard to wrap your brain around. A lot of tributes have been going on in the league to Kobe, which is nice. A lot of guys who wear 8 and wear 24 are changing their numbers. So Spencer Dinwiddie is changing his number to 26. Quinn Cook, who wore number 2, is changing his number to number 28 to honor Kobe and his daughter. Kobe used to wear 8. His daughter wore number 2. So 28. And then in other cases, guys are keeping their numbers as a way of honoring him. Zach LaVine and Lauri Markkanen of the Bulls, who wear 8 and 24 respectively, are keeping their jersey numbers as their way of honoring Kobe. The Lakers and the Clippers were supposed to play on Tuesday. That game got postponed, which was absolutely the right decision, because not only are those the two Los Angeles teams and they play in the same arena that he played in his whole career, a lot of guys on both of those teams have very close relationships with him. LeBron, especially, he and Kobe, you know, finally, once LeBron went over to play for the Lakers, they had really started to bond and had developed like a brotherly sort of relationship. And Kawhi Leonard, who is from the Southern California area, he and I are actually from the same town. He's always said Kobe was his favorite player. So a lot of those guys, Paul George too, are just, you know, totally affected by that. And I think that having a game between those two teams in that arena that close to his passing, it would have been a bad idea. And I think that when they do, whatever date they move that game to, whether it's in a month, whether it's after the All-Star break or not, I'm sure that they'll come up with a way to honor him proper. And actually, the league just announced about half an hour, 45 minutes ago, the changes they're making to the All-Star game going forward. So for the last few years, they've been trying to revamp the All-Star game, make it more competitive, which was a decision that Chris Paul actually made. Chris Paul is the president of the Players Association, so he has the commissioner's ear on certain things. And so in 2017, when he missed the All-Star game with an injury, he sat at home and he watched, and he realized, like, oh, this is what people complain about, because there's nobody plays defense in these games. So he and the league have been working pretty closely together to find a way to liven the game up, to make it more interesting to viewers at home. So what they're doing is they are changing the rules so that quarters 1, 2, and 3 are all, like, the score starts at 0-0. And then in the fourth quarter, you total up the points for each quarter and you add 24 to the score. So, like, if the West is leading 100-95 coming out of the All-Star or coming out of the third quarter, they only have to score 24 points to meet 124. Whereas the East in this scenario would have to add up to 124 by scoring another 29 points. So that's their way of honoring him. And the first three quarters, the winner of that will get money for charity, a charity of the captain's choosing. So LeBron and Giannis this year would do it. And it's a really nice way of honoring him. And there was talk of canceling all the games on Sunday afternoon as a means of honoring him. But just also because, like, so many of those guys were affected so hard by it. You know, we had shots of, I want to say it was Bradley Beal on the sideline just sobbing. You know, a lot of guys just crying their eyes out, just not in any position to play. And they went out there and did it, which is what Kobe would have done, because that's who he was. He was just this ultimate competitor. He would go out there and play, and I guess that was kind of the idea. We can't cancel these games so close to tip off, so let's just go out there and do it. I think that the rest of the season will probably be devoted to him by the league, and it wouldn't surprise me if they do a similar to what baseball does for Jackie Robinson Day. So Jackie Robinson Day is April 15th, I believe, and every team in the league, every player wears number 42 with no names on the back of the jersey. So it wouldn't surprise me if the NBA did something like that going forward. So let's say January 26th is Kobe Bryant Day, and everyone on one team wears 24, everybody on the other team wears 8. I would suggest doing it on August 24th, but they don't play basketball that early anymore. But yeah, it's like a death in the family. You know, it's Kobe was part of the league for so long and then was still so close to the league now that a lot of players had this closeness with him. He took on this role of mentor to a lot of guys. Jason Tatum is kind of the one that right away comes to mind, because Jason Tatum plays so much like Kobe. And was working pretty close with him his rookie season. Devin Booker, like I mentioned before, Giannis, Joel Embiid, a lot of guys took a lot of pointers from Kobe, just worked with him on a lot of stuff. And so to a lot of guys, they lost a mentor, they lost a big brother, they lost a friend, and the NBA lost a member of its family. And there was no real telling what he was going to do next. He had taken on a life of devoting himself to his daughter, his daughters, plural. But, you know, primarily Gianna was the one he was closest with. He was coaching her team. They were, you know, courtside at a lot of games together. And so it's a question of, you know, what was next for him. You know, he wasn't going to coach her AAU team forever, you know, because she wasn't always going to be in AAU. So let's say 5 years from now, she's in college. You know, what's next for him? Where does he go? Does he take on a more hands-on approach with the Lakers or with his hometown 76ers? You know, he had so many options open to him for the future, and so did she. And now we'll never get to see what either of them would have done. And more importantly than that, 9 lives, including theirs, were lost. And you know, my condolences are out there. My feelings are out there for Vanessa Bryant, for the families of everyone else, because it's shitty. You know, there's no other word for it. It's just totally heartbreaking, and you know, it's a sentence that I never thought I'd hear myself say, at least not this soon. And that's rest in peace, Kobe Bryant. Moving on a little bit. I've been playing a ton of Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic. I picked it up around Christmas. It was like $12. I think it was $6 for 1 and 2 individually. So I picked them both up for like $12. Man, that first game is really good. I've beaten KOTOR 2 before. I actually beat it last summer. Just to go back to it, just to see, like, hey, does this hold up? And it does. The game's still really good. And so is the first one. The first one might even be better. And I really like a lot of little things about KOTOR 2. But KOTOR 1 is the blueprint for a lot of modern RPGs, like modern Western RPGs. I played Outer Worlds late last year when that came out, and you can see KOTOR's fingerprints all over it. Especially like looking back at that game, where a lot of things with the way that you interact with the characters and the way the characters interact with each other, the level structure, or the area structure, I guess, where, hey, go to this planet, do all this stuff, go to the next thing, you know, and then go back to this old place to finish this other thing up. Like, for example, if you play in the order I played it in, where I went to Tatooine first for the first star map, or the second, technically, the first after Dantooine, I went there, did that, left, talked with Bastila about her mother, then we go back to Tatooine to talk to find Bastila's mom. You, in the structure of that game, feel a lot of what becomes the structure of games like Mass Effect, games like Outer Worlds, games like Fallout New Vegas, which, by the way, were all created by people who worked on this game, or people who worked with people who worked on this game. And it's just really good. It's a lot of fun. All the characters are really fun. I just finished up the party because I just got Jolie on Kashyyyk. It's interesting, though, because it's the start of a problem that exists in other BioWare games, where playing it, I end up spending a lot more time with certain characters than others. Like, when I played Mass Effect 2, the thing that I realized I was doing a lot was I was taking with me on missions, I was going like, all right, let's take whatever character I'm romancing and one other character. So a lot of times when I played Mass Effect 2, my party ended up being Jack and Garrus, or Jack and Grunt, or some variant of that, because that was the party makeup that I liked, where it's like, all right, here's the character that is my romance, and here is some other character that either I like or is good for this mission. And I realized I was doing that with KOTOR, where I'm playing, and it's like, all right, I'm taking Bastila and someone else. Where I did that on Dantooine, I did it on Tatooine, I did it on Kashyyyk. I'm making a concerted effort to try and switch away from that. So, like, on Manan, which I just got to, which is the third planet for the star map, or fourth, technically, I've taken Candorous and Jolie, or Mission and Jolie, like, just a different party, just because I want to switch it up. Because that's a problem that I run into with these games a lot. But as a whole, it's hard to think of any other Star Wars media from around that time, that 2002-2003 point, that still holds up really well. Because Attack of the Clones is terrible. You have that original Clone Wars show with the shorts, the Genndy Tartakovsky stuff, or Tartakovsky, don't remember how to pronounce his name. A lot of that stuff is still fun, still good. A lot of those books are impossible to find now. So this kind of remains, KOTOR 1 and KOTOR 2 do, these hallmarks of the Star Wars franchise that are very rarely acknowledged by Star Wars itself. Because when Disney bought it, they decided to just purge everything to start over new, which I understand is a concept, but now you're saying that it's hard to write this stuff because there's nothing to play off of, which is, there's nothing to play off of because you took it all away. But you look at KOTOR, and it's just this shining light, this beacon of how good this stuff can be, because it's expanding on a lot of the lore, a lot of the less explored stuff. Like, in all of the movies, there's 9 Star Wars mainline movies, and then there's the couple spin-off movies, the couple side stories. It's never explored anything with Wookiees. Like, the concept of the life debt is there, and you know that the planet is called Kashyyyk, but other than that, you don't know anything about Wookiee culture, right? Like, the concept of a Mad Claw is never mentioned, because I think it's something that was invented for this game. It's not something that the books might have expanded on. I only read a couple of those, and they were not very Wookiee-centric. But it's not something that the movies were ever going to talk about. You know, here's Chewbacca, he's what matters. And so you play KOTOR, and you go to Kashyyyk, and it's like, here's all this stuff about the Wookiees that's way more interesting than any of the stuff that you get in your primary material for this stuff. And it's a real breath of fresh air. Like, the relation between the Ewoks and the Tusken Raiders is really interesting, and it's only really explored in this game. It's never something that's mentioned in the other games, or in the movies, rather. And the thing that I think it excels at, this and KOTOR 2, and I think most of the games, is exploring the binary between the dark and light sides of the Force. And so you get that represented in this game by your three other Jedi companions, Bastila, Jolie, and Juhani, where Bastila is raised in the Force, is, you know, has been part of the Jedi since she was a kid. She's part of the system of the Jedi that in recent years people have kind of looked at and went, hey, what's up with this? What's their problem? And The Last Jedi, Star Wars Episode 8, tries to explore this before basically getting told, no, shut up. Where Luke in that movie is like, hey, the Jedi were wrong about a lot of things. And you've got that, and you've got Juhani, who falls to the dark side temporarily, attacks her master, and eventually joins the party if you choose to let her. And she is constantly afraid of, like, what will the dark side make of me? You know, if I don't keep myself in check, what will I become? And then you have Jolie, who left the Jedi Order, has been living in the woods on Kashyyyk for like 20 years. And so the game has, if you've never played it, has a little bar on all of your characters, like an alignment check. So they all fluctuate. Well, yours fluctuates, your main character, depending on your actions. And that makes it easier to use certain powers. So if you're dark side, you can use lightning and life drain and all the cool dark side powers a lot easier than someone that's light side can. But all of your party members have like a set morality bar. So like Bastila is light side. She is pure light side because she's indoctrinated into the Jedi system. Juhani is a little bit lower on the light side because she's recovering from being dark side for a little while. And Jolie is dead center between dark and light, because he's kind of the gray Jedi idea that you get a lot in the Expanded Universe books, where he's not evil by any stretch of the imagination. Jolie Bindo is a good man, but he thinks, you know, that all the stuff with the dark side and the light side is kind of stupid and doesn't want to do it. That's why he left the Order. And you just get this really interesting perspective on the dichotomy of dark and light and the duality of the Jedi and the Sith, where to get your lightsaber, to get your Jedi stuff, you have to learn the Jedi code, which is like, there is no emotion, there's peace, there's no, you know, all these things that you're used to, where it's like the speech Yoda gives of like, love leads to hate leads to anger, anger leads to suffering. Where when you go to Korriban, to the Sith temple, and you learn the Sith code, where it's like, the Sith are about passion. The Sith are about emotion, are about drawing strength from what's inside you instead of from nothingness, which is a concept that's explored in a lot of different things. Street Fighter even does this, where in Street Fighter, it's the Satsui no Hado, which is what powers Akuma, makes him super strong, versus Ryu's nothingness that he finally attains in Street Fighter 4, where he's like, I don't desire anything. I don't... there's nothing inside me, and that brings me peace, and that's what makes me more powerful. And that's always a fun thing to explore, that Star Wars, at least as it pertains to the movies, is never going to explore fully to what it can be, and that sucks. I've also been playing a bit of Assassin's Creed Odyssey, which is a pretty good game. I missed out on a lot of Assassin's Creed games. Like, I never played the first three, like the Ezio games. I watched a friend play them. I tried picking up Black Flag a few years after it came out, admittedly. And I liked the setting, I liked all the naval stuff, but I just couldn't get too into the game itself. I picked up Syndicate, and I liked that. I didn't really like the Jake sections, or Jacob. I really took a shine to Evie, though. I liked the way she played. And so with Odyssey, it kind of invokes that same thought process with that Syndicate does, which is, why would I ever play as the guy? It's very weird that this game gives you a choice at the beginning between which of the siblings you play as, considering that the story makes a lot more sense playing as Cassandra. Her look, her bond with Phoebe, and Alexios's look all are more conducive to her being the protagonist and Alexios filling the other role. It's very weird, but it's a really good game. You have a lot of fun combat options that let you do a whole lot of things that you couldn't do in previous games, that you can't do in a lot of other games, where this game has more in common with an action game than a stealth game. And even the stealth abilities are a lot of fun, where you're doing, like my favorite thing you can do in the game, stealth-wise, is, so Cassandra has a spear, and you can throw it, hit somebody, pull the spear out, throw it, hit somebody else, pull it out, and throw it, and get a third person. And you can clear out enemies that way, and thin out the amount of things you have to sneak past, and it's a lot of fun, the things you can do with that mechanic. With the overpower stuff, like, you can do so many different things with that game, and it's definitely the most fun I've had with one of these. Granted, I've only played three of them. I have Freedom Cry. I've yet to touch it, but I know it's, I've heard really good things about it. I just haven't played it yet, but playing Odyssey has made me more interested in these games and makes me want to go back to them. Like when I'm finished with this, I'm going to inevitably go back to Origins, because I've seen a little bit of that with a friend, and it looks really fun. It actually, story-wise, kind of looks more interesting than Odyssey, and Odyssey is really interesting, where you're doing, without spoiling it for anybody who hasn't played it, you have like a list of targets. And you have to go through all of that list to get to a bigger person, And the game isn't hiding that. It's like, kill all these people so you can kill this person, and that's really refreshing for the game to not be trying to spring it on you later. And it makes it more interesting when they do suddenly spring things on you, where you go back to somewhere or you go to a new location and you're locked in. And you're like, okay, you have to do this thing. You have to do this mission before you can do any of this other stuff. And that's pretty cool. It's a pretty good video game. If you like action games, if you like stealth, if you like big sprawling open worlds, if you like fighting animals, which is a thing you can do in this game. If you like, I don't mean like fighting a dog or anything, I should add, like, if you like tracking rare boars, like if you like Monster Hunter, basically, like a really pared down version of Monster Hunter where you're not getting to do all of that cool stuff, but you're learning enemy patterns and all that stuff, and the enemy also happens to be a giant lion. I would say pick this game up if you haven't already have it, because it's really good, and I can't recommend it enough. The other game I've been playing is WWE 2K20. I know this game came out back in October, but it had a ton of problems at launch. It had a ton of problems up to a month ago, and I asked yesterday on Twitter, reached out, and just asked, hey, is this game fixed yet? Like, does it still break when you try to do anything? And got a response that, yeah, it's essentially 2K18.5, and hey, I like 2K18. It's $30, so let's do this. So I picked it up, and I've pretty much exclusively played the My Career mode, which is my primary... the thing I do in these games the most. Any sports game that has a career mode, that's the thing I'm doing, especially if the career mode has a story, or if it has no story and is really good otherwise. Like, I've in NBA 2K, I primarily play my player, my career, versus MLB The Show, where there's no story other than, hey man, you play baseball. Cool. Done. And that's all I do in those games. Like, I played something like 60 hours of MLB The Show 19 last year. And I think only like 4 or 5 of those were spent in franchise mode. Everything else was career stuff. Because that stuff's fun to me. They're basically just RPGs. And as time goes on, these games lean more and more into the fact that they have more in common with Final Fantasy than they do with the NBA Jam or Blitz or anything like that. And that's really fun. 2K20, it plays like all the other games. They did do some weird control mapping stuff that I'm not a fan of. Like, for the last 9 games, reversals have been the right trigger. I think, actually, for all of the games since going back to like the PS2, it's always been R2 to reverse, and now it's triangle. And there's that and a few other different weird things with the way the game controls now that take some getting used to. But I'm having a lot of fun with it. I'm having a lot of fun with the My Career stuff. It's kind of the reverse that I was saying with AC Odyssey, because in Odyssey, it's a weird, like, why did you give me a choice between these two characters? Like, I know the one that I like better, and the one that makes more sense. But the story that they're telling with 2K20 kind of requires both parts, where you're playing a male and female superstar on their joint road to the Hall of Fame. By the way, the whole career mode is just one big in media res, where it opens on the day that they're going to go get inducted in the Hall of Fame, and then everything else is just, how did we get here? And that's pretty fun. And I'll say that Red, the female character, her voice actor, whose name escapes me currently, she is putting on a great performance. Like, almost too good for the game, where she is head and shoulders the best voice actor that they've got. Samoa Joe is a very close second, but that's because Samoa Joe is also a voice actor. You can do a lot of stuff with this game in terms of moves. Like, they added a bunch of stuff, but it's still got the problems that these games tend to have, where it's, you know, it's okay. I'm not gonna tell anyone to go out and buy it at full price, although full price now on a physical copy is $30. So hey, it's a lot of fun so far, even with the problems that it has. The career stuff just keeps getting better over the last couple years, too. Where 2K18s, I remember I bought 2K18 because I heard the career mode was better. Because 16, 17, I think 15, too. Like, the career mode was there, but it wasn't anything. Like, it was, hey, you have a promo tonight. You have a match tonight. There was no story to anything. And then in 18, they made a concerted effort to push it forward to have the story. And the fact that in 2K18 you have two completely different stories depending on what route you play. Where if you play as a fan favorite, a babyface, you get a tougher road, whereas the heel side, you get basically everything handed to you, and it's a lot of fun that way. That's what makes that interesting. Like, in 2K18's career mode, you have to start from number one in the Royal Rumble and outlast everybody. And that took me, no lie, I started that over what had to be at least 15 times, because I would get to like number 17 and get eliminated by like Mark Henry and Brock Lesnar or something. And then in 2K19, they took it a step up and added in the story with Baron Blade and BCW, where you're an indie guy who gets noticed at a tryout, and you get, like, it's not even your tryout, it's for someone else, and you get signed to NXT, and you have it all taken away from you very quick. Like, the night you get signed, someone attacks you, and they fire you, because we can't have somebody getting, you know, we can't have our superstars fighting fans in the parking lot. And then it's the road back. You know, it's how do I get back to where I was? How do I restart my career after being screwed? And then you get to this, where it's two best friends going from being bullied in high school to training to wrestling in the indies to NXT and so on and so forth. And you do a lot of neat things with that. Like, you wrestle a no disqualification loser leaves town match in Memphis versus Jerry Lawler. And you wrestle Lita in a baseball stadium, where they're adding all these little things in that are cool, that are not unlike the stories you hear a lot of times from wrestlers when you hear them talk. And it's really enjoyable. I hope 2K21 is a better video game and doesn't have all the problems that this one had when it launched. Because if they keep improving at the increments that they are improving with this mode specifically, they'll have like a legitimately really good game on their hands when they work out all the kinks. So here's hoping that they can do that. Getting into the news, this past Sunday was the Royal Rumble, live from Houston, Texas. They've started this trend of putting the Rumble in baseball stadiums that I hope they keep up, because I've always longed for them to go back to doing shows in baseball stadiums. Before last year's Rumble, the last time they, being WWE, had a show in a baseball stadium was WrestleMania 19, and that show has a really unique look. And so they're giving the Rumble its own identity and making it feel special in a different way by having it on this baseball diamond. The opening match, well, I only caught three matches so far. I'm going to have to go back and go through everything. But I caught the opener, which was Roman Reigns and Baron Corbin, or King Corbin, rather. And, man, if you want to talk about two people who do not get enough credit for how much they've improved, you don't have to look any further than Roman Reigns and King Corbin. You know, Michael Cole said it on commentary during the match, that you can make a case for Corbin being the most improved guy on that roster the last 2 years. And he is. He does so many things better now than he did 2 years ago. Than he did in NXT, than he did when he first came up, when he won Money in the Bank, all that stuff. He's come a really long way, and he's killing it in the spot that he's in on SmackDown, where he is, obviously the top heel is The Fiend. He's number two. He's a strong number two. And Roman is another guy who, when Roman first started getting pushed, when Roman first started appearing in more main events and popping off a little bit more, Roman got a lot of pushback, which was interesting to see happen. because people went from not caring about Roman and treating him like he was just the other guy in the Shield around the time that he and Rollins won the tag belts. So that would have been May 2013. You know, he was kind of just treated by fans as being the other guy because everyone already knew Dean Ambrose and Seth Rollins from when they were Jon Moxley and Tyler Black. And then he started to pick up steam later that year. Like, he had that great, great showing at Survivor Series in 2013 where I think he eliminated 4 out of the 5 other guys on the roster. There was the match where the Shield had to wrestle basically the entire Raw roster, and he hit one of the Usos. I want to say it was Jay. He hit him with a spear that looked like he killed him. And I remember being on Reddit around that time and seeing people getting more and more into him. And then the Rumble came. And I know a big part of this was that people were desperate for Daniel Bryan to get his spot at WrestleMania because that's what the story they were telling. That's what would have made the most sense. They say that it was the plan all along. It wasn't. But it was the outcome that made the most sense. And so when it was clear that he wasn't in the Rumble, and when it was clear that it was either going to be Batista or Roman Reigns, people were so ready to defy the reports, you know, that it had been, that it was going to be Batista, and he was going to go on and face Randy Orton at WrestleMania. People were so staunchly anti that idea that they started to cheer loudly for Roman Reigns. But it wasn't just at the Rumble. You look a couple weeks later when they did the Elimination Chamber show, you look at WrestleMania that year, you look at Extreme Rules, you look at, they did a match on freaking Main Event, and Roman was getting louder reactions at every show. I don't want to say he was getting louder reactions than Ambrose or Rollins, because all three of them were super over. But Roman was definitely getting these huge babyface pops. And then once the Shield split up and it became clear that Roman was going to be the guy, just like that, it happened. And suddenly, like, everyone knew Roman needed some polish, right? He needed some work. But suddenly it went from Roman needs a little bit more time to I can't believe they're pushing Roman Reigns down our throat. This guy's terrible. He's so bad. And it's like, yeah, he looks bad because he's out there wrestling Kane in the Big Show every week. And then when they started putting him in there with better guys, when they started putting him in there with Sheamus, when they started putting him in there with Cesaro, when they started putting him in there with Rollins and Ambrose and Styles, people slowly but surely turned around on him. But 2015, 2016, people were even, I would say, up until 2018, like early 2018, people were so staunchly anti-Roman, those couple weeks at the end of 2015 notwithstanding, because he got that monster reaction in Philly the night after TLC, and people were super into him, chanting, "You deserve it," when he won the belt. And then the narrative resumed that he was no good. But you look at him now, and they absolutely made the right choice with strapping the rocket to him. Now, knowing that their other choice was Big E does color things a little bit, because I would love to for Big E to be in that spot. And he will be one day. I really do think so. But for now, Roman is great. And he's really, really, really earned the spot he's in. And he just doesn't get enough credit, in my opinion, for how far he's come and how good he is now. But those two, Reigns and Corbin at the Rumble, they had a really, really good Falls Count Anywhere match that featured the loudest spot call I've ever heard. And I want to say it was from Robert Roode. There was a segment in the match where Roode and Ziggler came out to help Corbin. And then the Usos came out to even it up. And there's a spot where Roode and Ziggler are, you know, giving the work to Jey Uso, And then Jimmy jumps out of the bleachers onto them. The problem is, I knew that it was about to happen because one of them, I want to say it was Rude, starts yelling, "He's up there, he's up there." And then a second later, Jimmy Uso flies down onto them. Like, it happens, but boy. Boy, have all four of those guys been doing this too long for that to happen that badly. That match also features one of the best visuals I've seen in a long time. The finish came when Roman hit a spear on the dugout, because they're in a baseball stadium, so they wrestle up into the dugout, then they end up on top of the dugout. Reigns hits a spear, pins him, and is standing on the dugout in Minute Maid Park with his hand raised in a sea of fans, and it's just the coolest visual. And part of why I think the baseball stadium aesthetic really works, and hope they stick with it going forward. The women's Rumble match was the Bianca Belair show. It was a coming out party for Bianca Belair, who every time she appears either on pay-per-view or on TV, like when they were doing the NXT Invasion stuff, where she popped up on SmackDown and she press slammed Carmella over her head, like over a equipment box. Like, they know what a star they have in Bianca, because Bianca is pound for pound the strongest person in that company, at least the strongest person in NXT. Whether or not she's stronger than Cesaro remains to be seen, because Cesaro is a freak of nature. But Bianca's crazy strong. She's got a great look. She's ultra charismatic. And she's going to be a star. She's already a star, but she's going to be a bigger one. And I think they know that, which is why they made a point to have her break the record for eliminations, which I think was previously held by Charlotte and Michelle McCool. So she breaks that, sets a new record at 8, which Shayna Baszler broke later. Shayna Baszler, by the way, Shayna Baszler is like the final boss of women's wrestling. Like, I know that it seems like it's Charlotte, but the mood changes when Shayna's music hits. Shayna Baszler needs to be on the Mania card somehow. And I've heard the rumor that she's going to be wrestling Becky for the Raw Women's title, which, great, perfect, awesome. That is the perfect thing for her to be doing, especially given the way their last encounter ended up, where Shayna made Bayley tap out in that triple threat match of Survivor Series, but Becky wasn't pinned or made to tap, and then Becky put her through a table to end the show. So those two somehow getting into it at Mania, great idea. Because Shayna absolutely deserves it. And I've said for years that deserving in wrestling is a myth. But Shayna Baszler has been incredible down in NXT. And I don't think there's anything left for her to do. You know, she's had this mini program going on with Shotzi Blackheart, who I'll talk about in a second. But I think after the next TakeOver show, which I think is next week or in 2 weeks, TakeOver Portland, Shayna doesn't need to be in NXT anymore, at least for a little while. I know that now they're treating NXT, SmackDown, and Raw like lateral moves. So I think right now she needs to make the shift over to Raw for a little while, at least. Especially considering what the rumored plan for WrestleMania is for the winner of that Rumble. Really quickly before I talk about Charlotte, Shotzi Blackheart. What a month Shotzi Blackheart is having. Like, what a great 30 days. She debuted in NXT in that... she was in that Battle Royal for the number one contender. She showed up in the Rumble match. She had that match with Shayna on NXT TV. And then last night, She showed up in a freaking tank. She shows up in a tank as part of her entrance in NXT, which I'm assuming is going to be part of it going forward, because it is literally too cool to not be part of it going forward. Now to Charlotte. Charlotte Flair wins the Royal Rumble match, which it's surprising that they were able to hold off until year three to have Charlotte win it. She wins, and the rumor is that she's going to challenge the NXT champion instead of the Raw or SmackDown champion for or at WrestleMania. As of right now, the second that I'm recording this, that champion is Rhea Ripley, which is an interesting matchup. Charlotte has talked in the past about how she wants to work singles matches with women who are bigger than she is physically, because Charlotte's a very tall woman. Charlotte, I want to say, is 5'10", 5'11". Ripley is about 5'9", 5'10". But Ripley is, like, jacked. Like, she's... like, if you were to look at them, you would assume that she's the stronger of the two. A lot of times, Charlotte is working with women smaller than her. Bayley, Sasha, Becky, Ronda, Alexa Bliss, Sarah Logan, Liv Morgan. Like, a lot of the women on the Raw and SmackDown rosters are smaller people physically than Charlotte is. Very rarely is she up against someone a similar height and build to her. So it would be really interesting to see her work with someone that she doesn't have that dynamic with. Now, at TakeOver Portland, Bianca Belair is going to challenge Rhea Ripley for the title. I do not see her beating her, but Bianca versus Charlotte is also a new match with that similar dynamic. Bianca's a little shorter than Charlotte is, but she's still got that strength aspect. She's not the usual opponent that Charlotte would be facing. So there's a lot they can do there with the two of them. And those two need to have a singles match soon anyway, because they had a few interactions in the Rumble, and from what I saw, I really like what they're capable of together. So it could be a lot of fun to have that match, maybe for the title, maybe her and Rhea, maybe her and, it's unlikely, but her and Dakota Kai is a possibility, because Dakota Kai is at least, they've been setting her up as a big heel in NXT. And she seems like the logical challenger for whoever the champion is coming out of WrestleMania. And I think her and Tegan Knox have some sort of last woman standing match, I quit match, something like that at TakeOver. I guess it would be TakeOver Tampa, which is weird because they're usually in Orlando, but I digress. But at that show, there's a possibility they have some sort of big gimmick match to blow their feud off. And then they're both freed up. So they both make good challengers for whoever's next. The men's Rumble match was equally dominated by a storyline early. And that was Brock Lesnar, the WWE champion, entering the Rumble. There was a lot of confusion I saw from people about Brock being in the Rumble, where it was, well, if he can't challenge himself, yeah, obviously. The idea is Brock wins the men's Rumble, avoids having to defend the title at the Rumble event, and if he wins, he gets the chance to become a double champion. It's a win-win for him. It makes perfect sense for him to be in that match. Brock dominated like the first like 17 entrance, something like that, before Ricochet and Drew McIntyre teamed up to eliminate him by exploiting his weakness, his testicles. Why everyone does... this happens in every Brock Lesnar match. Every single Brock Lesnar match since like 2015, he gets hit in the nuts. If Brock is going to lose, he is going to get hit in the nuts. And the fact that every Brock match isn't just booked around someone trying to hit him in the nuts is insane to me. because it just makes sense. Like, if I'm a wrestler, in storyline, it's like, you got to face Brock Lesnar. It's like, okay, well, how quickly can I get behind the ref's back and punch him in the balls? Because he's always wide open. You would think by now he would invest in a cup. But he doesn't, so guys keep exploiting it. McIntyre eliminates him. Edge returns, which was... Edge coming back always seemed like the biggest impossibility. You know, it always seemed like Austin coming back. Where Austin, even if Austin wasn't, you know, over 50 now... Is Austin over 50? I'm going to go ahead and say yes to that. Even if Austin wasn't the age that he is, a return for him always seemed highly unlikely. Like, hindsight being 2020, there was a lot of times 10 years ago, I want to say around 2011, 2012, there was a lot of scuttlebutt around him coming back to wrestle a match with CM Punk, which was never going to happen. Because Austin would never be medically cleared. And it was the same thing with Edge, where Edge retired in 2011, went in the Hall of Fame in 2012. And he seemed like the guy who would never get cleared because his neck was so bad that, by his own admission, if he took one bad bump, that would have been it. And so here we are 9 years later, thanks to the magic of modern medicine, Edge is back in the ring, and... It's not full-time, but it's not a one-off appearance. The report is that he signed a 3-year deal for limited appearances, $3 million a year, I think. And it looks like his first program is going to be with Randy Orton. There's a lot of guys that he can work with going forward. There's a lot of names that are out there that would be interesting to see have a match with Edge. Aleister Black... right away comes to mind. Buddy Murphy, AJ Styles. There's a lot of guys out there that he can wrestle after he's done with Orton. I don't think he's going to show up every month. I think he'll be on a Brock-like deal. I don't expect him to be in like the Money in the Bank match or anything like that. God, I hope he's not in the Money in the Bank match or anything like that. But... it's just really good to see Edge back, because now he gets to go out on his own terms, which is great. And he's in great shape. He's ripped. He's in better shape, I think, now than he was, you know, 12 years ago, which were like those prime Edge years. He is shredded. He looks great. And finally, Drew McIntyre picks up the win in the Rumble. The rumor is that As of Sunday morning, there were two names floated around to win the Rumble. Aleister Black and Drew McIntyre. They went with McIntyre. I'm kind of the opinion they should have gone with Black, but that's because I like him more. My reasons for not liking Drew McIntyre have nothing to do with Drew himself and everything to do with the way that Drew has been talked about a lot over the last decade, which is that a lot of times, people were putting down other wrestlers on the show who shared traits with him. 9 times out of 10, those wrestlers were Black. Putting them down and insinuating that he deserves better than to be feuding with them. The two that jump out at me, and I think this might have happened with R-Truth too, but Kofi Kingston and Cedric Alexander. Kofi, a lot of people, I've talked about this, it's in the feed, the Kofi Mania thing I did last year around WrestleMania time. But Kofi was a guy who was considered boring while Drew was wasted potential. But Drew, in his first run, didn't really show a whole lot in terms of personality. Like, his character was, I'm the chosen one, and I walk really slowly to the ring, and I bully Teddy Long. And his character when he came back was, I'm Scottish, I'm large, I'm going to stand here and interfere in all of Dolph Ziggler's matches. Or I'm going to team up with Shane McMahon for some reason. And I think it might... It's one, the way that Black wrestlers are viewed, and two, the way that babyface characters in wrestling are viewed, where a babyface, you have to almost be a comedy character to really resonate with people, or you have to be, oh, this guy's a tweener, you know, he's not a babyface. Or you have to be a heel and then turn back face. So a heel, but you're doing all the heel things, but you're doing them against heels. So now you're a face. Drew McIntyre and Buddy Murphy is also a beneficiary of this. When you're a heel, you can stand around and do nothing. You can say nothing, show no personality other than smirking every so often, and you're golden. And now McIntyre's a face, and he's showing a little more personality. He's showing a little more fire. And so if they let him do some of the things he was doing as Drew Galloway on the indies, I'll be way on board with this. But they still have that really strict no pile driver rule, even though they let everyone and their mother do a reverse Frankensteiner, which is essentially a more unsafe pile driver. Hell, they let Adam Cole do the Panama Sunrise, which is a pile driver. He does a flip first, but that's a pile driver. Give McIntyre the pile driver back. Give him his old theme music back. Not even permanently, just for like a promo package. And I'll be way back in. But as it stands right now, pretty neutral about him versus Brock at WrestleMania. And pretty into the other match that I've seen floating around, which is Aleister Black and Seth Rollins. That match isn't going to be for the title or anything, but it should be good. It should be fun. Last thing I want to talk about before we get out of here. Eli Manning last week announced his retirement from the NFL. He retires with a record of 117 wins and 117 losses, 2 Super Bowl MVPs, 2 Super Bowl appearances. And the conversation, the question is Eli Manning a Hall of Famer? I'm of the opinion that he is not. And I think largely the reason why there is the consideration that he is because, well, he beat Tom Brady in a Super Bowl. Sure. He was part of a team that did that. It's the way we talk about quarterbacks is inherently unfair in their favor, where when a team succeeds, the quarterback gets more credit than other players on the team because they are the offensive captain. But that Super Bowl that Eli won, they only scored twice. You know, that was a defense heavy game. They just happened to score 2 touchdowns. If you had, let's say that in 2006, that the Bears had beaten the Colts, we would not say that Rex Grossman is a Hall of Famer for having won a Super Bowl against Peyton Manning. Because Rex Grossman was never that good, and we can accept that. But I think because of the way we talk about quarterbacks, where when a team succeeds, it is the praises laid at their feet, and the fact that Eli played in New York, played in a huge market, and won those 2 Super Bowls against Tom Brady, he is afforded this, like, oh no, he's great. But those 2 years, those 2 Super Bowl seasons were also the only seasons under Eli Manning that the Giants won a playoff game. The only playoff games that he ever won were in those 2 seasons. He, I believe, most seasons led the league in interceptions. And I actually, on Twitter, I put up a little experiment to see, just looking at raw numbers. I put up two different QB stats. One was Eli Manning in 2011 when they won a Super Bowl, and the other was Derek Carr in 2016 when they went to the playoffs. The Raiders did. And more people, I just asked, like, you know, who, which of these two would you rather have without knowing who is who? And most people said Carr. Again, they didn't know that it was Derek Carr. This was just based from a numbers perspective. The one who didn't being Ryan, who I don't know how he did that. But look, from a numbers standpoint, Eli a lot of time was turnover prone. He did not throw a lot of touchdowns. He was a serviceable NFL quarterback, but I wouldn't put him in my Hall of Fame. You know, he's definitely a Giants Hall of Fame guy, but he, by any stretch of the imagination, to me at least, from where I'm standing, I wouldn't put him in the Hall of Fame just because he didn't blow it in those two Super Bowls. You know, you look at his career numbers versus Phillip Rivers' numbers. Nobody thinks for a second that Phillip Rivers is a Hall of Fame quarterback. But you look at his numbers versus Phillip Rivers, and Phillip Rivers had the more impressive career in terms of numbers. Phillip Rivers also happened to play his whole career with the Chargers. His whole career to this point, because I think he might play again next year, probably for the Dolphins. You look at the comparison between their numbers, Phillip Rivers had the better numbers with a worse team, every year. The Chargers, I don't think, ever looked like a contender with Phillip Rivers there. And Phillip Rivers threw better than Eli Manning his whole career. That's going to do it for this episode of the Player Advantage Podcast. You can find me on Twitter at Archer Arios. That's ArxHerArios. I will be back again next week talking about some more stuff, talking more comics is the plan. And I have a couple ideas for some things I want to do in the near future. Some video stuff, some written stuff. Another thing I'm definitely going to be talking about next week is the finale to The Good Place, which is on tonight. Tonight being Thursday. It'll be probably be Friday or Saturday when this goes up, but I'm recording this on Thursday. The Good Place finale is on tonight. I'm going to talk about that show a lot next week because that's a great television show, and kudos to them for ending when they wanted to instead of dragging it out too long. And again, that's Archer Arios on Twitter. Until next time, take care, stay safe.